everybody, I'm Dee Dee West, and welcome back to Broken Limelight. I know it's been a while, you might have heard if you follow me on Facebook that my life kind of took some sharp turns, but I'm back and I've been working on this case for months. Today's episode is about actor and radio star Bob Crane. Bob Crane came to fame in the mid-60s when he landed the lead role in a sitcom called Hogan's Heroes, which was a comedy about a prisoner of war camp during World War II. I know that sounds kind of shocking if you're not familiar, but it was actually crazy successful. Bob was known as charming, talented, kind. People had all these really pleasant and delightful words to describe Bob Crane. And people started to see Bob and his character, Robert Hogan, as one and the same. On June 29, 1978, Bob was found murdered in his condo. He appeared to be bludgeoned while sleeping and also had a cord wrapped around his neck. There were no signs of forced entry into his condo. Today, this case remains unsolved. There are suspicions and theories about who the murderer might be. Sadly, a lot of gossip and rumors about Bob Crane spread like wildfire upon his death, and the media chose to tell a story about Bob that didn't show the full picture. See, when investigators arrived at the crime scene, they discovered that Bob had a collection of photography and filming equipment, as well as Polaroids and videos showing him having sex with dozens upon dozens of women. After this information got out, all anyone could talk about was Bob's scandalous sex life. Many theorize that Bob's dark secret had to have been connected to his murder. If you've seen the 2002 film Autofocus, I need you to know that this is not an accurate portrayal of Bob Crane. The filmmaker himself has admitted that he was not interested in creating an accurate portrayal of Bob Crane so much as he was trying to sell a juicy story. With that said, I want to tell you about the sources that I used for this episode. My main source for this episode is the book Bob Crane, The Definitive Biography by Carol Ford, Linda Groundwater, and Dee Young. I actually spoke to Carol Ford and Linda Groundwater, who are endorsed and supported by Scott Crane and the Bob Crane estate, and I got a lot of insight into Bob's story. Carol and Linda were kind enough to send me a copy of their book and allow me to interview them for this episode, and we'll get to that interview in a bit. But I want to say that I highly, highly recommend this book. The authors interviewed over 200 people who were close to Bob, including his friends, his children, his co-stars, and even people from his childhood. Bob's youngest son, Robert Scott, who they call Scotty, has said that this book is the only true and accurate portrayal of his father's life. In fact, you can see his comment on the Broken Limelight Facebook page from Robert Scott Crane, where I posted about this interview that I did with the biographers, and Scott commented, "The estate of Bob Crane and I both worked closely with Carol and Linda and immeasurably appreciate all of the hard work and dedication they put into this book. The only truthful and accurate account of my dad's life." So today we're talking about Bob Crane. It's actually Bob Crane's birthday today, July 13th. It's also Harrison Ford's birthday and Cheech Marin's birthday. It's also my sister's birthday. She's in Costa Rica, but happy birthday, Stephanie Alicia. So, Bob Crane was born Robert Edward Crane on July 13, 1928 in Waterbury, Connecticut. His parents were Rosemary and Alfred Thomas Crane, who married in 1925. Bob had an older brother named Alfred Jr. They grew up in a traditional Roman Catholic household. Rosemary, the mother, was known to be kind, while the father, Alfred, was known to be a little more strict, but loving and proud of his sons. Bob spent his childhood and teenage years in Stamford, although the family moved around a lot from 1930 to 1942. He started drumming at age 11 after his father bought him his first snare drum for Christmas. Al picked out a $23 snare drum and asked the owner, Vito, to hold on to it until Christmas. His name is Vito Scigliampaglia. I am not even a little Italian, but it's in the book. So Al picked out the snare drum and asked the owner, Vito, to hold on to it until Christmas. When Al came back to get the drum, Vito had already sold it to somebody else. Al had said to him, "I promised my boy a drum for Christmas, and by the holy saints of Ireland, he's going to have one." And then he grabbed another drum that was worth $75 and just walked out with it. Vito felt bad about his mistake, and he just looked the other way. Years later, when Bob became famous, Vito hung up a picture of him from Hogan's Heroes in the store and wrote, "I, Vito Scigliampaglia, am responsible for the show business career of Bob Crane, star of TV, radio, and movies." What a leap, right? Like, forget Bob's hard work and his natural talent. Let's give thanks to Vito for being a shitty salesman. Bob's drumming career increased after he saw American jazz drummer Gene Krupa performing at the 1931 World's Fair. From then on, he was never seen without his drumsticks. It's said that at this point, music and drums were as much a part of him as breathing. By junior high, Bob was organizing local drum and bugle parades with his neighborhood friends. He played snare drum and timpani in his high school orchestra and snare drum in the school marching band. He played for the Connecticut Symphony Orchestra and the Norwalk Symphony Orchestra. His parents thought this was a pipe dream. They wouldn't let him use the family car to get to gigs, so he had to rely on rides from his friends. His friend Edwin recalls the home feeling rigid, and he disliked going inside of the home. And Bob seemingly couldn't wait to get away. Edwin had said that he believes Bob has a side of him that he was keeping locked up, festering inside of him for a long time. Bob graduated from high school on June 5th, 1946. In 1948, Bob proposed to Anne just a couple weeks before high school graduation. Anne was his high school sweetheart. Around this time, Bob became interested in volunteering for the military. He joined the National Guard, and in his 2 years of serving, he rose from the rank of private up to corporal. There are some sources that say that Bob's friends claim that Bob was very focused on his career up until he met Anne. At that point, he shifted his focus from his career in show business and music onto their relationship, often choosing to be alone with her instead of working with the band. This actually is not true. As a matter of fact, Bob was creating radio shows and playing them for his best friend and Anne, and no one ever saw him at school without his drumsticks, even after he started dating Anne. Anne also joined the high school band to be with Bob, playing the glockenspiel. In May of 1949, Bob and Anne got married in a Roman Catholic church in Stamford. They befriended another couple who had just gotten married in the same church just an hour earlier. And coincidentally, this other couple had plans to take their honeymoon in the Poconos Mountains in Pennsylvania, where the Cranes were also planning to take their honeymoon. Even more coincidental, they all ended up booking the same hotel, so the two couples spent their honeymoons together. Around this time, Bob took a course in radio techniques, and he began applying for jobs at various radio stations. In 1950, he was hired at a newer station, WLEA, and he left the National Guard with an honorable discharge and went on to focus on a career in radio. Bob and Anne didn't have a lot of money, so Anne lived with her parents while Bob traveled for work. Anne got a job as a secretary to help support her parents, and Bob and Anne had a seemingly happy marriage. He spoke very highly of his wife and was said to never lose his temper. Like one time, Bob came home with mud on his shoes and stepped all over their white carpet. Anne's mom berated him, and that made Anne really embarrassed. She actually said, "Mom, that's Bob's carpet. He bought everything in this house." And he'd just stand there and take the abuse, saying, "No, no, Annie, I was wrong. I'm sorry." He was kind and patient and was rarely seen angry. He also didn't drink or smoke, and he often asked bartenders to make him, like, mocktails so nobody would question why he wasn't drinking. His vices were sweets, like candy and cookies. Though he seemingly spoke very highly of his relationship with Anne, Bob was actually frustrated and seemingly discontented. While many believe that Bob's extramarital affairs began when he got to Hollywood, they actually started early on in his marriage with Anne. Early in their marriage, Anne's family was dealing with the crisis, so she and her mother went to Sweden while Bob stayed in Stamford working at a jewelry store. He was restless, and he continued sending letters to radio stations up and down the East Coast. When he was offered a position at WLEA, he packed up his bags and moved to Hornell, New York to focus on his radio career. When he got there, he was shocked to find out that he wasn't offered the job of announcer, but rather the job of a maintenance man. Still, he took the job. He really wanted to go to New York. It wasn't long before he would become the announcer anyway. Within a month of being hired, he was promoted to program director. By now, the couple was struggling and considering divorce. Now in a new city and reeling from his home troubles, Bob started dating another woman. Sources say that they were together for a few months and were intimate, even talking about the possibility of marriage. And to be clear, it seems that Bob and Anne were both mutually separated. Like, it doesn't seem like he was dating this other woman and still with Anne at the same time. So Bob and Anne continued working through their divorce, and they ended up mutually deciding to mend their marriage, and Bob moved back to Connecticut. Shortly after moving back, in August 1950, Anne's father passed away unexpectedly from surgery complications at just 49 years old. Anne and Bob were devastated about this loss, and they struggled to support each other financially. They had debated a bit about Bob quitting his job and moving back home, but before he could even make the move, he was offered another job at WBIS in Bristol, Connecticut, and he took it. When he got there, he wasn't what they were expecting. It turns out that when they heard his audition tape, they had accidentally turned down the speed of the tape, which made his voice sound a lot deeper than it actually was. Bob said, When he heard me speak, he was pretty disappointed, but he liked my sense of humor, so he kept me on. Before long, Bob was promoted to program director and senior announcer. He lived in a boarding house in Bristol, and he would return home to Stamford on the weekends. He made $45 a week and would supplement his income by playing drums at clubs. Needless to be said, money was super tight. Bob had no refrigerator, so he would keep his milk on the windowsill outside. He would often, have to run home to check on his milk to make sure it, hadn't gone bad. After only 3 months at this job, Bob was offered yet another job as an announcer for the station WLIZ, whose only stipulation was that Bob not be a drinker. And he was not a drinker. But this was because they had problems with other announcers coming to work hungover. Now, this job was a lot closer to home, and it paid $10 more. Here, he would become the program director and station's operations manager. The company then bought the station WICC, where Bob would continue his work. In 1952, Bob was promoted to program manager for WICC, and by 53, he was operations director. The thing that makes Bob really special is that he was very, innovative with what he did on the radio. He was known to introduce gimmicks to his radio shows. For example, he would do voices and he would have conversations with himself. And then he would also, play recordings and then respond to them as characters. Like once he did an ad for milk and he poured water into a salt shaker and then he would shake the water from the shaker into a glass to make it sound like he was milking a cow. And while doing this, he was joking around about this is how fresh the milk is. He was very clever and nobody was doing these things. He would also play the drums on the air. He was creative and called a lot of attention to the radio station. For Valentine's Day, he asked the female listeners to send in kisses to the radio station. For months, the station received letters and cards covered in lipstick marks, to the point that the health department served WICC with a notice to stop the promotion, as they thought it would be unhealthy for the postal carriers to handle all this kissy mail. Bob also had this gimmick where he would have a chicken rate the new records. He would have this chicken drop eggs into a basket, and the more eggs it laid, the worse the record was. He really pushed the envelope and took chances making his radio show a big hit. It wasn't long before he became a star. He was now making $500 a week, equivalent to over $4,000 today. Now, Bob and Ann were able to get their very first home of their own. They got a duplex apartment, and they relocated to Bridgeport, Connecticut. In 1951, Bob and Ann welcomed their first child, a son they named Robert David Crane. This is the son who, on some podcasts and in some articles, you'll see him referred to as Bobby Jr. Nobody actually called him this. This wasn't something his parents called him. I guess Robert David Crane started referring to himself as Bobby Jr. after Bob died. It was a nickname he gave himself. Bob and Ann decided to ask Ann's mother to move in with them, as she was now a widow. She moved in and she would cook and clean and lovingly dote on her grandson. While at WICC, Bob continued sending out letters and tapes to try to break into an even bigger market. He was offered an opportunity for his own radio show in Los Angeles, California. It was a bit of a challenge to get him to go to LA because he really wanted to go to New York. This would also be a huge change for Bob and Ann. Also, at this point, their son is 5 years old, so it's a big change to move all the way from Connecticut to California. Regardless, the family ended up moving to the West Coast, and on September 3rd, 1956, the Bob Crane Show made its debut. Bob came to be known as the King of LA Airwaves. His show became so popular that KNX asked him to add live celebrity interviews. He interviewed thousands of celebrities on the air, like Jane Mansfield, Marilyn Monroe, Natalie Wood, Dick Van Dyke. And celebrities enjoyed being interviewed and even roasted by Bob. In June of 1959, Bob and Ann welcomed their second child, a daughter named Deborah Ann. A year later, they had another daughter named Karen Leslie. Bob and Ann doted on their children. Neighbors recalled Bob taking his kids trick-or-treating or to Little League practice. It was said that Ann often took charge while Bob was working, but Bob was indeed a family man, and neighbors were proud of Bob and his family. When they found out that they were pregnant with their second child, they celebrated by going to the movies. They saw the film Tunnel of Love, and Ann remarked that the character Dick Pepper reminded her of Bob. In retrospect, this is funny, because the Dick Pepper character is a fun-loving guy who engages in extramarital affairs and even justifies being a womanizer and believes that straying away from your marriage should be acceptable. After the movie, Ann said to Bob, "You know, I just spent 90 minutes watching you." At that moment, a light bulb went off in Bob's head. This is the moment when he first got the idea to try his hand at acting. Bob had never acted before or even studied acting, but he was determined and he was a quick learner. He decided to read and study and learn everything he could so that he could know everything about the entertainment industry and be one step ahead of everyone else. Bob finally got the guts to go into a theater where a stage production of Tunnel of Love was playing and inquired about auditioning for a role. There, he met a director and acting instructor named Don Freed, who turned out to be a huge fan of Bob's radio work. Bob got the part, and he advertised the play heavily on the radio. Critics were super positive, which motivated Bob, but KNX was not excited to lose him to Hollywood. His contract actually included a clause preventing him from acting professionally for 5 years. Bob's schedule was hectic. He worked hard in this play, on his radio show, and at home raising his small kids. He was offered gigs doing voiceover work, and he got bit parts on shows like The Twilight Zone. In 1961, Bob renegotiated his contract, allowing him to pursue an acting career. In 1962, Bob made a guest performance on The Dick Van Dyke Show. Less than 2 weeks later, he was invited to be a guest star on The Donna Reed Show. Donna Reed personally called him and asked him to be in her show. He originally played a character named Dave Blevins, but he was so well-liked by the cast and the audience that he was asked to return as a recurring character, who would be Donna's neighbor, Dr. Dave Kelsey. Bob signed a 2-year contract, but by the end of the second season, he grew bored and asked to leave the show. He continued pursuing work in community theater productions and small film roles. But once Bob left the Donna Reed Show, his income was sliced in half. He was eager to take on another acting role, but he didn't want to be typecast as just the guy across from the main girl. Bob was picky about his roles, which was frustrating for producers. Then, he was told about a role of an all-American type for a show called Hogan's Heroes. Hogan's Heroes was about Colonel Hogan, a U.S. Army Air Force colonel who was imprisoned in a Nazi POW camp. Instantly, Bob was turned off of the idea, thinking there's no way anybody's thinking this is going to be funny. And there is actually one part of the film autofocus that really made me cackle. Again, this is not a source for this story, but I had to watch it because I had to understand the intense, like, dislike for this movie that some people have. But anyway, in the movie, Bob's character is sitting with his agent, and the agent tells him about this role and how it's in a World War II POW camp, and Bob says, "So it's a drama?" And the agent says, "No, it's a comedy." And Bob says, "Oh, you mean with the funny Nazis." According to Bob's cousin, Jim Senek, Bob didn't want to do the show at first. He was sensitive to the hardships that soldiers had endured and the stressful issues that they were facing, and he didn't want to insult them. He also felt that the show was poking fun at POWs, many of which had truly suffered during imprisonment. Bob agreed to do the show only after a trailer was shown to veteran groups, and they all agreed that it was fabulous. They loved the trailer, and Bob was sold. Fans would later say that Bob Crane was made to play the role of Robert E. Hogan. And this trailer that was shown to the veteran groups actually turned out to be the pilot episode. And also, in the opening credits of the show, you hear drum beats. That's actually Bob playing the drum. Partway through the first season of Hogan's Heroes, Bob decided to let go of his radio show. It just became apparent that he couldn't physically stay healthy and handle the 2 full-time jobs. So he had to pick one, and Hogan's Heroes made its primetime debut on September 17, 1965. Fans began to see Bob Crane the actor and Colonel Hogan the character as one and the same person. To Bob, this made him realize that maybe he was being stereotyped. Hogan's Heroes ran for 6 years, from 1965 to 1971. Everyone involved said that it was a dream of a show to work on, with little drama behind the scenes. However, some would speculate that this isn't true. Bob Crane and actor Richard Dawson seemingly had some kind of falling out. People believe this because Richard Dawson was Bob's best man in his second wedding, but for some reason he didn't attend Bob's funeral. It turns out that that might not really be an indicator. Like, Dawson was just one among many other people in the cast who didn't go to his funeral, so it might not even be relevant. Like, Bob did acknowledge that there was some professional tension between him and Richard Dawson, but him not showing up at the funeral isn't an indicator of that. If the name Richard Dawson is familiar to you, it's because he was the host of Family Feud. He was the one who would kiss all the female contestants. Do you know what I'm talking about? I'm sure there's someone out there who doesn't have a clue what I'm talking about. But if you watch old episodes of Family Feud with Richard Dawson, in fact, look it up on YouTube, or you know what? I'm going to upload it to BrokenLimelight.com. So he was the host, and when he would greet the female contestants, he would kiss them, all the women, on the lips. And some of these women would even, like, lean in and kiss him before he could. Like, it was icky, and I think these women were starstruck, and he milked it. But anyway, Richard Dawson also tested for the role of Colonel Hogan, but he didn't get it. Many people involved in the show just indicated it wasn't really intended for Dawson at all. Again, they were looking for an all-American type, and Bob he fit the bill. I had mentioned earlier that Bob's extramarital affairs actually started early on with his first marriage, but it's a popular misconception that this didn't start until he got to Hollywood and joined the cast of Hogan's Heroes. Most notably, he had two girlfriends who were in the cast of Hogan's Heroes, and those are the two that most people like to talk about. During the first season of Hogan's Heroes, Bob started dating Cynthia Lynn. This was not his first affair, nor was it exclusive, but it was one of his most serious. Bob started seeing Cynthia while he was still married to Anne, and Cynthia was also married, although her marriage was also deteriorating. According to Cynthia, her husband Lee was a macho Italian man with jealousy and a gambling addiction. Bob and Cynthia admitted to each other that they were each in marriages that they were unhappy in, and began telling each other that they loved one another. Soon, Cynthia felt she couldn't keep her feelings a secret, and she confided in her friend, who ended up running to tell Cynthia's husband Lee. Again, Lee is a jealous type, so he ran home with flowers and told Cynthia that he wanted to patch things up. She was hesitant, but he was super persistent, so she agreed to try to work on the marriage, and then Lee demanded that she had to quit working on Hogan's Heroes. She felt that if she wanted to save her marriage, she had no choice but to quit. But Lee would not allow her to talk to Bob anymore, even to explain herself. So that was pretty much the end of that, and Lee went directly to the producers of Hogan's Heroes and explained that Cynthia's not coming back to work. The producer tried calling Cynthia and convincing her to stay and reminding her, like, you have a contract, but she did what her husband asked. The producer was understanding and kind and told Cynthia he's not going to sue her for breaching her contract. Cynthia never spoke to Bob again, and 3 months later, her marriage to Lee ended for good. She was sick of his gambling and his spending all of her money, so she filed for divorce. She regretted her decisions both to leave Bob and her career in Hogan's Heroes, so after leaving Lee, she tried to get her job back on Hogan's Heroes. Sadly, her role was given to someone else. They literally had just signed the new contract 1 day earlier. So Cynthia's role, which was a character named Fraulein Helga, became Fraulein Hilda, and now the role belonged to Patricia Olsen, also known as Sigrid Valdez. Since the producers were fond of Cynthia, they did allow her to come back playing bit parts throughout the show's run, but it was super hard to join the cast because Bob now started dating Patty, and they were deep in the affair. Cynthia noted that when she came back, Bob was different. She said, "I can't explain how, but he was different. He didn't seem happy. He didn't have that spark, that sparkle that he always had." Patty Olsen went by the stage name Sigrid Valdez. She joined the show in the beginning of season 2, and Bob was very supportive of her. He urged producers to give her more screen time, and it didn't take long before they began a romantic relationship. So they started filming season 2 of Hogan's Heroes, and Bob started dating Patty, and he took her under her wing. And in 1969, Bob got her a role in Cactus Flower, where they worked together until returning to Hollywood to film Hogan's Heroes' 5th season. By now, Anne and Bob's marriage was beyond repair. They would start taking vacations separately, and their friends started to become suspicious. Bob's affair with Patty would be the breaking point for Anne, who requested a separation. After about a month, rumors began to circulate about Bob and Patty's affair. In a rare interview, Anne said, "Are you shocked that Bob and I are separated? Well, you're not as shocked as I am, as the children are." In May 1969, just short of their 20-year anniversary, Bob was actually the one to pack up his things and move out of his family's home. Then Anne filed for divorce. Anne's petition says, "Defendant Robert Edward Crane has treated the plaintiff with extreme cruelty and has wrongfully and without reasonable excuse, cause, provocation, or justification inflicted upon plaintiff grievous mental suffering which has impaired her health and destroyed her happiness." Anne also filed a restraining order stating unplanned and unwanted visits caused severe emotional upset and trauma to her and the children. The split was shocking to everyone, as Bob often claimed that he not only loved his wife and children, he cherished them. He told people time and time again that he didn't understand people who, quote-unquote, went Hollywood. and why they couldn't just be normal, like he and Anne, whose idea of a good time was going home to watch a movie together. Their daughter Karen recalls Bob telling Anne repeatedly, "I love you, Annie. I never should have left you." There's no doubt, however, that Bob also loved Patty. She saved love letters from Bob that were passionate and filled with tenderness. Not very long after the divorce was finalized in 1970, Bob found out that Patty was pregnant and proposed to her. Interestingly, Bob had gotten a vasectomy and was shocked to find out that Patty was pregnant. He had gotten the procedure done in Japan, where apparently they didn't tie off the vas tubes, they just cauterized them, which leaves a risk that they can reconnect, which apparently is what happened to Bob Crane. He later took a paternity test and confirmed that he was indeed the father. The couple were married a week later. The divorce left Bob with very little money. However, since both he and Patty worked for a successful TV show, and the network was more than happy to capitalize on their union, the pair got married right on a soundstage next door to the set of Hogan's Heroes. Sadly, this meant that they had little control over their special day. Patty, who was naturally a brunette, was made to wear the blonde wig that she wears in Hogan's Heroes as her character, Fraulein Hilda. They also weren't able to choose who was on their guest list. And this also made me wonder if that's how Richard Dawson ended up being his best man to begin with. More importantly, people were left off of the guest list in order to make room for reporters. That sounds special. In 1971, Bob and Patty welcomed their only child, a son named Robert Scott Crane. He's also referred to as Scott. When Bob's friend asked him why he named both of his sons Robert, Bob just said, "I like that name." According to Bob's cousin Jim, Bob's divorce was really upsetting to his extended family. Not only were they devout Catholics, but they adored Anne and they accepted her as their own family. On the other hand, nobody in the family was really fond of Patty. The subject of Bob's divorce and subsequent marriage to Patty was like a taboo topic. Bob's father, Al, took to his grandkids, all of them, and they remember him as being kind and sweet. But Bob's mother, Rose, was cold and distant. Scott, Bob's youngest son, recalls that she was really mad at Bob for leaving Anne and marrying Patty. Life seemed to be settling down for Bob's first wife, Anne, who was now engaged to a realtor named Charles Sloan. Bob continued to support Anne financially until she remarried, and he supported the children into adulthood. In time, Anne, the kids, Charles, and Bob would all accept each other as a new combined family, and they would spend major holidays and family events together. Anne took care of their three kids, Robert, Deborah, and Karen, and Bob and Patty took care of their son Scott and Patty's daughter Melissa. Bob and Patty also adopted a 17-year-old Mexican immigrant. This was a girl who had been hired to assist Patty with cooking, chores, and childcare, and then they adopted her. It sounds, to me anyway, like they weren't adopting a child so much as a servant. But it turns out that this was a common practice in Hollywood during the 1970s. I'm just gonna put a pin in that, talk about it some other time. Aside from being in front of the camera, Bob was also a huge fan of photography and filming technology, especially as new technology continuously came about in the 70s. Bob and Patty got a big house in Hollywood where he kept a massive collection of video and audio equipment in the first level of their home. In 1971, Bob bought one of the first video cameras ever made and started filming everything, from everyday life at home to family vacations to behind the scenes on the set of Hogan's Heroes. He said he felt lost without his camera and he took it everywhere. He even kept a second camera in his dressing room while filming. Bob would even show his son Scott how to create radio shows by letting him play with the microphone and set up turntables when he was as young as like 4 or 5 years old. The 70s were a time of transition for Bob. His home life was beginning to look up. He had achieved stardom with Hogan's Heroes. But he was also starting to worry that Hogan's Heroes was the height of his career and there may be nowhere to go from there. He made cameos on TV shows here and there, but what he really wanted to do now was launch a film career. He worked on an educational film called Patriotism. And then he tried to get cast in The Godfather because he knew one of the producers who had also worked on Hogan's Heroes, but unfortunately, he was looked over. Now, Bob and Patty had an understanding in their relationship. It was an open relationship, and Patty seems to have approved of his behavior because she would give him birthday gifts like trips to strip clubs and things like that. She publicly stated that she would pardon his behavior as long as he came home to her. Bob's interest in photography and filming crossed over into his love of women and sex. He had what we would now acknowledge as a sex addiction, but at the time, that wasn't a thing. He began to photograph and film himself having sexual relations with numerous women. Although Patty allowed him to do this, she ended up being unhappy in her marriage and serving Bob divorce papers in December 1977. Bob said in an interview, "All she had to say was irreconcilable differences, but she did a character assassination on me, and I don't know why. She called me cold, heartless, and said I neglected the kids and a lot of other untrue things. Anyone who knows me and the kids knows better. I was shocked by those statements, but not by the divorce." Patty was also asking Bob for money, which he just didn't have to give her. Not only was he not making as much money as he had hoped, but his business manager, Lloyd Vaughn, had been embezzling money from him for years. This wasn't discovered until about a year and a half after Bob died. And it was only because Patty found out and she pressed charges. Lloyd Vaughn pleaded no contest and was ordered to pay the Crane estate $108,000 for the $75,000 that he had stolen while working for Bob. He also spent a year in jail. Eventually, he called Bob's son Scott and apologized for his actions. Bob never knew that his manager was stealing money from him. Bob was always described as restless, driven, always wanting more. This applied in his professional life as well as his personal life. He rarely slept, requiring only a few hours of sleep in order to function at his very best. He was also obsessively chronicling extraordinary details of his life. And this goes back to when he was in school. He used to keep detailed journals and would write notes, take pictures, make videos, and create audio tapes of any and all events. He recorded and cataloged his radio shows using the Dewey Decimal Tape System. He photocopied and archived fan mail, made scrapbooks and collected newspaper clippings. He collected and chronicled anything and everything he could. Bob's son Scott says that Bob was always journaling, jotting down ideas for plays or direction. He'd write on the back of records and circle his favorite songs and even jot down the times of his favorite moments in the songs. He kept a detailed date book, and if he didn't actually do something that he wrote in the book, he'd go back and notate why it didn't happen. He also had his own dark room in his home where he would develop his own photography. Bob was always a charming and handsome man, but especially upon reaching fame, he got a lot of female attention. Though he initially only wanted to look and not touch, he liked to charm women, but he would only go so far. At some point, one woman said, "Put up or shut up," at which point he gave in. Like Bob, Anne also came from a religious household. A friend of Bob's recalled having a conversation with Bob about him and Anne both wanting to be more intimate, but they felt their religions didn't allow it. Now, the first time that rumors of Bob's infidelities and lust for women began to circulate was actually in the 50s, back when Bob was working at WICC in Bridgeport. It was commonly known by fellow staff and jazz members that Bob was engaging in extramarital sex with multiple women. Some were worried that this was becoming dangerous, as Bob would hit on women right in front of their husbands or boyfriends. His colleagues and bandmates felt like they needed to babysit him, like a little boy, to keep him out of trouble. And it seemed like Bob didn't see any harm in his behavior, like he didn't think he was doing anything wrong or that anything bad would come from it. By the time Bob got to Hollywood, he had already engaged in a number of flings, a couple serious enough for him to consider leaving Anne. California was new. It was open and free and laid back and thrilling. And Bob learned to become more discreet, building thick, thick walls around him. Though there was talk of his infidelities, it still came as a shock to those around him to find out the extent of his addiction. Bob was learning to close people off and engage in conversations without actually divulging any information about himself. He made people feel like they had a deep, lengthy discussion when really, he didn't actually say anything with much depth. At some point, Bob began to say that he didn't like to date actresses because watching them work made them feel kind of unsexual, so he saw them as colleagues, just like the other male actors. It's possible that he actively chose to start viewing women this way because he received backlash for his womanizing behavior on the sets of other shows like The Donna Reed Show. Others who have worked with Bob Crane have described him as someone very wounded. More than one has mentioned that he required a sort of feminine understanding. He needed tenderness and a lot of hugs. It seemed to many that he was desperately seeking love and acceptance. The biographers I spoke to noted that maybe Bob wasn't just addicted to sex, but to love. He was capable of having long-term relationships, and he never struggled to take no as an answer from a woman. It wasn't something that he felt entitled to. It seems that Bob only wanted sex if they were both enjoying it. It was important to him that the woman was having a good time as well. The last time many of Bob's longtime friends saw him was at their school reunion. Bob was described as being very happy to everyone outwardly, but there was a nervous energy, like something was bothering him. More and more, his happiness felt artificial. Initially, Bob was in control of his sex life, and he kept it separate from his professional life. But eventually, he would lose that control. On the set of the Bob Crane show, he makes jokes that were kind of racy. He would bring Patty, and she would stand at a profile, emphasizing the size of her breasts, and he would make jokes about it. Like, that was the bit. When Bob worked on the Disney film Superdad, he announced in a meeting with a Hollywood reporter that he likes to play drums in topless and bottomless bars, and what's wrong with that? The reporter published this story, and Disney broke ties with him. This was the first glimpse the public would get at Bob's proclivities. However, most would just kind of glaze over this until later, after Bob died. Bob began doing a dinner theater production called Beginner's Luck at the Windmill Dinner Theater, which toured to multiple locations around the country. Although dinner theater was a step down in Bob's career, and he acknowledged that, he took this work seriously. He was also able to more freely feed his addiction, which was completely in control of his life by now. While some of his friends in the theater saw the side of Bob to the point of them becoming uncomfortable, others never saw it. He truly had two sides, two personalities, and he kept them separate. Bob befriended an actress named Victoria Ann Barry at a topless bar and would invite her to play a role in Beginner's Luck. She got great reviews and Bob was proud of her. Early on in their tour, Bob asked Victoria if he could film her in a provocative setting. She says that she allowed him to film her once, but she became uncomfortable and let him know it. Bob instantly stopped. Like a light switch, he turned off any desire to film her and never asked her again. Victoria said that after that, Bob became very much like a father figure to her instead and took care of her. She called him a gift to the industry. Bob began working on a show called The Hawaii Experience. The show's director, John Orland, found Bob to be professional and kind, and all the wonderful traits that we keep hearing about Bob. But John recalls an experience while filming that was an indication that Bob was beginning to fail at keeping his addiction separate from his work. He was filming a promotional video on a sidewalk in Honolulu when a woman walked by. In the middle of his on-camera interview, Bob suddenly just turned around and ran after this girl. Like, he literally just left in the middle of this interview and started chasing after a woman walking down the street. Just took off, and they had to go and get him and, like, bring him back to the set. And then he just, like, laughed it off. In early 1978, Bob taped an episode on the Canadian cooking show called Celebrity Cooks. After Bob died and his secrets came out, the decision was made not to air that episode in the United States. A CBS spokesperson claimed that Bob had been acting sleazy in the episode, stumbling through it, making jokes about sex and talking about death. It turns out that none of this is true. In fact, the episode still aired in Canada, so you can probably find it and watch it for yourself. In the book Bob Crane, The Definitive Biography, they interviewed three people who were directly connected with the Celebrity Cook Show. These were Derek Smith, the owner and producer, Ann Keir, a talent agent, and Robert Packer, the stage manager. By all three accounts, Bob was one of the best guests to ever appear on their show, and they were appalled that one spokesperson's version of events had been accepted by the truth. In fact, on June 27, 1978, just 2 days before Bob's death, he sat down for an interview with a reporter. This would be his last interview ever. Of course, neither Bob nor the reporter would know that. In this interview, Bob talked about his stalled movie career, but he was optimistic about the future. He spoke openly about a split with Patty, but he was otherwise in good spirits and had a positive outlook, and his sunny personality came shining through. He laughed his way through much of the conversation, and he mentioned that if he should ever write his own autobiography, he would title it Laughing All the Way to the Grave. It's interesting, though, how you never hear about that interview. While working on Beginner's Luck, Bob met Reverend Ed Beck, an employee of the Windmill Dinner Theater Corporation, who also happened to be an addiction counselor. Beck would be the one person to whom Bob would share his deepest, innermost thoughts, beliefs, and troubles in the weeks leading up to his murder. He declared to Beck that he was an addict, and he actually used the word addict. He was keenly aware that he was losing control of his situation, and his life was beginning to fall apart because of it. His first marriage fell apart, and he was in the process of his second divorce. Although it seemed that he and Patty were working on patching things up, the marriage was in serious jeopardy. The children were suffering, they started to hear the rumors, and they began to ask Bob questions, and he couldn't honestly answer these questions in good conscience. That was hard for Bob. He really wanted to be a good father. And on top of all this, he was building a reputation in his career, and Hollywood executives were starting to lose respect for him. Bob admitted to Beck that he tried to break his addiction in the past several times, but he always failed. He knew that this was going to be a long, painful road, but he was ready to heal. He knew this would be a lifelong struggle and he'd always be just one woman away from relapsing, but he was determined to overcome it. Bob didn't know his life was coming to an end. He had every intention of getting through his addiction, becoming a better father, repairing his reputation, and continuing to make strides in his acting career. Bob's counseling with Beck was supposed to be completely private. He would have never disclosed any of it, but he did so after Bob's murder to try to give the media and the public a better understanding of Bob's inner turmoil. It seemed to Beck that Bob was very aware of his problem, and he was determined to gain control of it. Beck thinks that what really pushed Bob to make this choice were his children. He needed to be a good father. Beck was not specialized in sex addiction, so he was just trying to evaluate Bob just enough to be able to diagnose him and refer him to another counselor who was specialized. He was in the process of connecting with top psychiatrists and trying to find the right one for Bob. In speaking to Bob, Beck found that Bob didn't see himself as sick or dirty. It seems that, like I said before, it was important to Bob to provide women with pleasure. He wasn't just trying to pleasure himself, he legitimately seemed to want to make women feel good. According to Beck, Bob always had consent to photograph or film the women he was having sexual relations with. Bob's family has reiterated this. There have been a couple of women who have come forward to say that they had no idea they were being filmed. Bob's family insists that his cameras were always out in the open, they were never hidden. Beck says that upon Bob's death and the stash of amateur porn being revealed, multiple women, including important women, have contacted him asking what would happen to those tapes. It seems that in all of these sexual encounters, most, if not all of these women, were not really worried about the tapes being seen by anyone but Bob. And I mean, this was brand new technology, so there was really no concept of nudes being leaked or revenge porn or anything like that. So I kind of wonder, like, all of these women seemingly felt safe being recorded by Bob. But after Bob's death, the media turned Bob's porn collection into a huge scandal, and I think that's the moment when the women in the tapes saw what could be at risk by having these photos revealed. Giving up his addiction meant more than just changing his future. Bob was pretty much living a double life, so he also had to separate himself from that part of him. He needed to destroy all of his work, all of this hundreds of films and photographs and a room full of files. He also had to separate himself from shady people he had gotten involved with. This includes his friend John Henry Carpenter, who would become the number one suspect in Bob's murder. Beck says, Bob's problem was that he created an appetite from certain people in that dark world who saw him as the chef, so to speak. He theorizes that on the night Bob was murdered, he had tried to cut ties with John Carpenter. Now, John Carpenter was a video equipment salesman for Sony when he met Bob on the set of Hogan's Heroes. In fact, Richard Dawson was the one who introduced them. John Carpenter was savvy with cameras and audio and video equipment, so he would often be hired by famous clients to help with installations and repairs and stuff. As Bob was also interested in this kind of technology, the two naturally struck up a friendship. They would go out to bars together and pick up women, and women would throw themselves at Bob, and John Carpenter would, like, tag along, and he would, like, effectively get women to sleep with him pretty much just because he was with Bob. Bob would, at some point, start introducing John as his manager. Carpenter probably wouldn't have been getting laid night after night if he wasn't by Bob's side. When Bob was on tour for Beginner's Luck, John would travel to meet up with him so that they could score women together, as well as photograph and videotape their encounters. The men would sometimes participate in group sex. Although investigators don't believe that Bob was homosexual, they did theorize that perhaps John was bisexual and had romantic feelings for Bob. Then when John became a suspect, they would theorize that John murdered Bob when he tried to sever their friendship because it was actually like this man that he loved severing ties with him. John actually referred to Bob as the goose that laid him golden eggs, because Bob provided him with a luxurious lifestyle with unlimited sex. He was like, why would I kill him? Multiple people believe that Bob had decided to make a change in his life and was trying to sever his friendship with John. His oldest son, Robert, said that Bob called him just a couple days before his death and told him that he's 2 weeks shy of his 50th birthday and he was ready to make changes in his life. Bob's daily planner, his little journal where he meticulously documented all his plans, had no mention of John Carpenter after the date of June 29th. On the evening of June 28th, 1978, this is the evening before Bob's murder, Bob and the cast of Beginner's Luck had a normal show. John Carpenter was in the audience. Victoria would sit with him during her off scenes, and John was never seen leaving the theater at any point. But after the show, he and Bob walked out to the car, and they would find that Bob had a flat tire. I mention this because some believe that the tire had been disabled during the play while all three, Bob, John, and Victoria, were all inside the building. The cast took their final bow for the run of their show, and Bob said goodbye to Victoria, telling her not to forget their appointment for the next day. He had offered to help her make a recording to send out for jobs, so they were planning on meeting the following day. Bob waved goodbye to Victoria for the last time as he and John headed to the car. When they got to the car, that's when they noticed that the tire was flat. It turns out that the valve cord had been cut, so someone had deliberately tried to disable his car. It's theorized this may have been a first attempt to murder Bob, as the killer may have planned to strike Bob as he kneeled down to change his tire. But instead of changing it there, Bob decided to drive across the street to a service station and put on a spare. So Bob and John hit a couple of bars and hot spots like the Safari, where witnesses say they saw them having dinner and talking. Some witnesses say that the men were raising their voices and appeared to be arguing, while others say that they were speaking normally. They met up with two women and had an uneventful night. At about 2 a.m., John took his date back to his hotel. He put the moves on her, but she asked to go home, and he took her home at about 3 a.m. Then he went back to his hotel, called Bob, and asked him how his night went. Bob told him that he also struck out with his day, so now he was just, like, sitting in his boxer shorts editing the bad words out of a tape of Saturday Night Live for his son. His youngest son, Scott, is now 6 years old. According to John, he had initially asked Bob for a ride to the airport, but on the phone before hanging up, he told Bob that he didn't need a ride anymore and he's just going to, like, take a taxi or a shuttle or something. In the early morning hours of June 29th, 1978, Bob would be sleeping soundly in his condo in Scottsdale, Arizona. He was lying on his side with his hands tucked under his head and pillow when someone struck him in the head twice with a camera tripod, crushing his skull. Bob was killed instantly, and the murderer then cut the electrical cord off of a video camera and tied it around his neck like a bow tie. A flaky white substance was found on the inside of Bob's leg. There was writing in the walls that was written in Bob's blood, and the messages seemed ritualistic in nature. The killer at one point peeked outside the window, leaving a bloody handprint on the curtain. There was no sign of forced entry, and Bob was known to keep his doors locked. The back door, which was a sliding glass door, was also unlocked. This led investigators to believe that Bob either invited someone into his apartment or left the doors unlocked deliberately for someone, or somebody had a key. His time of death was estimated to have been around 4 a.m. The next morning, John Carpenter returned his rental car and headed for the airport. Victoria Barry had an appointment to record with Bob that day, and he didn't show up. Again, Bob was super punctual, so this was very unusual. She called him, but she got no answer, so she went to his condo. She knocked on the door a few times, but nobody answered it. She noticed that the newspaper was still outside and the drapes were closed, and this was also unusual. Finally, she tried the doorknob and it was unlocked. When she went inside, it was super dark, so she started calling out Bob's name. As she enters, she finds this brutally beaten body in the bed. There's blood spatter on the wall, behind the bed, all above the body, and it's all over the ceiling. And again, there's writing in blood. And Victoria actually was kind of confused about who it actually was in the bed at first. It wasn't clear to her that it was Bob. So the condo was being leased by the Windmill Theater, so they contacted the manager to identify the body. That happened to be Reverend Beck. He was also the manager of the building. But when Beck showed up and he looked at Bob, and Bob was laying on his side, his skull was so smashed in and there was blood everywhere, and he wasn't able to identify the body. So investigators made the choice to roll the body over so Beck could get a better look at him. The Scottsdale Police Department was small in 1978, and they didn't have a homicide unit. There weren't enough murders to merit one. They made a handful of choices that, if you're a true crime buff like me, you'd know that these kind of choices are likely to contaminate the crime scene and invalidate evidence. A medical examiner named Dr. Heinz Karnitschnig we'll call him Dr. K, arrived at the crime scene at about 4 p.m., and he filmed a video of the crime scene. On the video, you can see Dr. K using a straight razor to shave a portion of Bob's head so that he can get a good look at the wound. He believed the killer had to have been a male based on the strength needed to make the blows, and I believe also based on the blood spatter. They believed it couldn't have been a female. But it was strange that the electrical cord was used to strangle him after he was bludgeoned. A possible theory is that if the suspect was a woman, maybe she strangled him after to make sure he was really dead, just in case her blows to his head weren't strong enough to kill him. The flaky white fluid that was found on Bob's leg was not collected. From what I gather, DNA analysis wasn't advanced. Like, it wasn't a thing until the 80s, so they just decided not to gather it at all. They basically jumped to the conclusion that it was semen, and investigators actually said, "What's it gonna tell you, that he had a piece of ass before he was killed?" Actual quote. Of course, they jumped to more conclusions when they found all of the evidence of Bob's secret hobby. While investigating, police found video equipment, cameras, a makeshift photo lab, and dozens of videos of Bob having sex with numerous women. In his home, they found hundreds of Polaroids of naked women and evidence of Bob having sex with multiple different women. The crime scene was not properly sealed and evidence was not properly handled. Evidence was collected in the same bag, possibly allowing for contamination. People were smoking cigarettes in the room with the body. Numerous people were allowed into Bob's apartment while his body was still there. This includes Bob's oldest son, Robert, who was 27 at the time, who removed items from the scene before they were checked for prints. There was also Bob's business manager, Lloyd Vaughn, an attorney named Bill Goldstein, and of course, Victoria Berry, who found the body. At one point, the phone rang and police allowed Victoria to answer it before checking it for fingerprints. The caller on the phone was John Carpenter. So investigators spoke to him and he told them that he was Bob until about 1 a.m. But then he would later change it to like 2:45 a.m. So then John says he got on a plane at about 10 a.m. And according to investigators, during this whole phone call, John never asked what happened to Bob or like, why are the police over there? So the autopsy was performed on June 30th, 1978. What we know is the time of death is estimated to be around 4 a.m. The cause of death is listed as blunt force trauma. There was no sign of struggle, so Bob seemed to be in a deep sleep during the attack. Bob had numerous contusions, including on his left upper lip, left eyelid, left temple, and two parallel horizontal fractures to the skull behind the ear, measuring about 4 by 2.5 inches. Bob did not smoke, drink, or use recreational drugs. His vital organs, other than his brain damage, are listed as healthy and normal. There was minimal aspiration of blood in the lungs, meaning he died almost instantly. The white flaky material was found on the right lower abdomen, right anterior thigh, and in his pubic hair. Again, this material was never collected or tested. And lastly, the murder weapon was unknown until 1990, but it was determined to be a camera tripod. Also, nothing of financial value was taken from the crime scene, eliminating the suspicion of robbery as a motive, to the investigators anyway. But there was a small photo album missing that contained photos of Bob's female companions. When the pictures and videos and the amateur porn were found, investigators started to wonder if they were somehow related to Bob's death. Like, perhaps Bob was murdered by an angry boyfriend or husband of one of the women he slept with. There aren't many women whose names we can confirm, so that's really hard to look into. But they were looking at one person in particular, John Henry Carpenter. Police theorized that after John took his date home, he might have gone to Bob's apartment. Maybe they put on one of their films and Bob felt comfortable enough going to sleep. There were witnesses like waitresses at the restaurants who claimed that Bob and John were having tense conversations or raising their voices, or that John pouted when Bob didn't pay attention to him. But then it was found in transcripts that police kind of fed the word tense to the waitress in this interview. Other witnesses said that Bob was nice to John and they didn't notice any problems between them. Bob's son Robert told police, "There was an indication just in a passing conversation with my father that Carpenter coming into town was getting to be just a bit of a pain in the ass. My dad expressed that he just didn't need Carpenter kind of hanging around him anymore." So police theorized that John had feelings for Bob, like romantic feelings, and he murdered him when Bob tried to end their friendship. When investigators saw the white substance on Bob's leg, they believed that it meant Bob was having sex with someone right up until the moment that he died. Some would also speculate that someone, like maybe John, killed Bob and ejaculated over him. Again, nobody ever tested this material, so we don't even know if it's from a female or a male, or if it's even bodily discharge. Bob had jotted down an entry in his daily planner that said, John leaves at 10 a.m., and it was crossed out. So it seems that the plan was for Bob to give John a ride to the airport. He also left a couple things on the bed, like, that looked like he was going to give them to John. Like, he left out a pair of swim shorts that belonged to John. John says, no, I called Bob and told him I didn't need a ride anymore. I took a cab to the airport. Police decided to investigate the rental car that John had been driving in Scottsdale, where they found 7 bloodstains all on the passenger side. John says he has no idea how they got there. The car was immediately impounded and processed. Unfortunately, again, no DNA analysis until the 80s. They were able to find that it was indeed human blood, and it was type B positive, which is found in about 9% of people in the United States. Coincidentally, Bob Crane's blood type is also B positive. According to police, there was no one else who handled that rental car who had the blood type B positive. With the blood evidence and witnesses saying that they saw Bob and John arguing, police were convinced that John was the killer. Unfortunately, they didn't have anything concrete to arrest him. At one point, they got really excited when a housekeeper at the hotel that John was staying in reported that she came across a bloody pillowcase and washcloth in his room, but she threw them away. Police never gave up trying to prove that John was the killer. The blood was tested 4 times over the late 80s and the early 90s, but it always came back inconclusive. In 1990, the case was reopened and the police re-interviewed everyone involved, believing again that all signs pointed to John. While reviewing crime scene photos, investigators noticed a bloodstain in the sheets that was shaped like the letter V. They compared it to numerous objects and they found that it matched the shape of a camera tripod. Furthermore, it was known that Bob always kept 2 tripods set up, but only one was found. The murder weapon was finally determined after 12 years. Police theorized that John beat Bob with a tripod and then tossed it in the passenger seat of his rental car. While reviewing the photos, police noticed a round red substance on the inner panel of the passenger door. For some reason, they hadn't clocked this particular stain when they originally investigated the car. Judging from the photos, pathologists determined that it was likely tissue from someone's skull. Again, this was either never collected or lost over the years, so we have no way of knowing for sure. But it was suggested that this was brain tissue, just from looking at photos, and this was supposed to be, like, tiny. But this was enough for the police to get a warrant and arrest John again in 1992. He was charged with first-degree murder of Bob Crane. When the case went to trial, John's lawyers pushed the narrative that Bob's sexual conduct with numerous women meant that any number of angry boyfriends or husbands could have had motive and means to murder Bob. Ultimately, there wasn't any physical evidence tying John to the murder. John Carpenter maintained his innocence until he passed away in 1998 of a heart attack, while the murder of Bob Crane remained unsolved and the majority of the public still pointed the finger at John. In 2016, the blood samples were tested again. Shockingly, the blood in John Carpenter's rental car did not belong to Bob Crane. So did John Carpenter have some other guy's blood and brain matter in his car on the exact day that his buddy was found murdered? Well, that's how the police make it sound. But from what I gather, these bloodstains were like 1/16th of an inch in diameter. I mean, it's said that they could have been missed when the car was being cleaned. Like, maybe the blood was there from the person who rented it before John and the rental company just didn't clean it well. But then if John Carpenter didn't kill Bob Crane, well, who did? Bob's oldest son, Robert, said, "For me, it was always one of 2 people, either John or my stepmother." That would be Bob's second wife, Patty Olson. So what do we know about Patty Olson? Before Bob, she was married to an entrepreneur whose name was George Gilbert Atea. Patty filed for legal separation, but they never fully divorced, and they lived together with their daughter Melissa until George died of unknown causes in 1967 at 46 years old. And she was 32 years old. So just 3 years later, in 1970, Patty married Bob Crane and gave birth to their son, Robert Scott. Now, by 1978, Patty had filed for divorce, but it wasn't yet finalized, and according to sources close to the family, they were working on saving their marriage. Some witnesses have said that they heard Bob having a heated phone conversation with Patty just a couple days before his death. Now, why would Patty kill Bob, especially if they were in the process of divorcing? Well, according to Robert, if there's no divorce, she keeps what she gets. if there's no husband, she gets the whole thing. Though Bob didn't have a lot of money at the time of his death, his estate would end up inheriting millions of dollars after NBC struck up a new syndication deal for Hogan's Heroes. Since Patty was still technically his wife, she would become the sole heir. Did she know about the syndication in advance, or was that just luck? Patty would die in 2007 of lung cancer at the age of 72. Just before her death, she had Bob's remains exhumed from his plot in L.A. and moved to a new plot in Westwood Cemetery so that when she died, they could be buried together. Then she and their son Scott set up a memorial website for Bob. Initially, they also used the website to sell some of Bob's amateur porn. Scott took down the website after a few years, and he explained to the biographers Carol and Linda that by selling the films on his site, he was doing the wrong thing, but for the right reasons. He wanted people to see that the women were enjoying themselves. They weren't being forced. He was trying to clear his father's name. They hadn't been drugged. They were very aware that they were being filmed or photographed. And in many instances, they were performing for the camera. Scott has now destroyed all of Bob's amateur pornography. Bob's official biographers have been pushing for Bob's inclusion into the Radio Hall of Fame, which they began in 2012, and Scott fully supports and endorses. I had also read that Patty updated Bob's will just 3 months before his death so that everything would go to their son Scott, cutting off all of his other children. But a person can't just update another person's will like that. And also, Bob had been paying Ann alimony up until she remarried, and he paid her child support for the rest of his life. By all accounts, Bob was not a deadbeat dad. In addition, Bob's alimony and child support payments ate up most of his salary. After the murder, Patty had to sell their upscale Hollywood home and move to a lower-income neighborhood, eventually leaving California for a while and relocating to Seattle with Scott, where he went to public school. But also, the autopsy said that the killer couldn't have been a woman. There's also a forensic pathologist called Dr. Michael Hunter from the show Autopsy, and he also says that Patty couldn't have been the killer. Just 4 hours before Bob died, she called Bob on the phone from her home in Seattle, so she couldn't have gone to Arizona to kill him. And again, the forensic evidence showed them that a woman of Patty's stature would have left a different arc of blood. So I guess it couldn't have been a woman, but could a woman plotted it and sent somebody else to kill it? Of course. I mean, I always consider that. And there is another woman who some people theorize might be behind this. And that's Victoria Berry, the actress who found Bob's body. Now, it's often been reported that Victoria and Bob had been engaging in a romantic relationship, although Victoria had a boyfriend. And like I said, as Carpenter's lawyers were trying to shift the blame off of their client, they pointed the finger at some of Bob's romantic partners, or alleged romantic partners like Victoria Berry. Victoria was questioned at the crime scene, and she told investigators that she and Bob had like a father-daughter relationship. According to the podcast and the show Autopsy, Bob had offered Victoria the leading role in a film that he was preparing to do in the following month. Bob had apparently offered Victoria a role in a TV series that he was preparing to do in the following month. But unfortunately, Bob met another actress named Gail Sunny Rogers, and he started a relationship with her, and then gave her the role that he had previously offered to Victoria. So this raises a theory that Bob might have given her the bad news shortly before his death. Some witnesses have reported seeing Victoria having a heated phone conversation with Bob just a couple hours before he died. Another thing that people have questioned about Victoria was, remember how I mentioned that there was a photo album that was missing, that it was full of pictures of Bob's sexual conquests? He had apparently shown that photo album to John Carpenter the night of his murder. But now when Victoria was being questioned at the crime scene, she was carrying a large handbag, and none of the officers ever checked her handbag, so there have been some questions about maybe she took the photo album for some reason. To further complicate matters, Carpenter's legal team suggested that Victoria's boyfriend and manager, Alan Wells, had motive to murder Bob Crane. Two witnesses claimed to have seen a white Cadillac with California plates around Bob's apartment at the time of his death, which happened to fit the description of Alan Wells' car. But Alan Wells was never questioned. Now, there was an eyewitness who claimed to have seen a man leaving Bob Crane's condo on the morning of his murder, and he says that the man he saw was not Alan Wells. Interestingly, he said it wasn't John Carpenter either. Years later, the biographers interviewed Victoria and they took her back to the crime scene. They got as far as the doorknob and she went to turn it, but she wasn't able to go in. And she had been so traumatized that they didn't want to take her any further. They didn't want to add to it by bringing her back into the crime scene. So, is there anyone else who wanted Bob dead? Well, investigators said that they didn't interview a single woman who disliked Bob or was mad at him about the photos or the videos. But again, we don't know any of the women who were in the films. There was one other guy I read about who supposedly had a violent argument with Bob and swore to get vengeance. This was like an actor in Texas. But as far as I can tell, this lead was never looked into. In 2002, a film based on Bob Crane was released called Autofocus. This movie was inspired by a book called The Murder of Bob Crane. The biographers I spoke to are adamant that this movie and the book that inspired it are not at all an accurate representation of Bob's life, and it seems that many of Bob's loved ones agree. You can even go to their website and look at their blog, and there are several articles where the makers of the film confirm that this film is not the biography of Bob Crane and was in large part fictionalized. I'll post a link to that blog on BrokenLimelight.com. Bob's daughter Karen said, "I haven't seen it. I won't see it. I don't need to see it. My dad was an absolute typical family man at home. I just have wonderful memories of my dad, and they never would have made a movie about my dad as a nice family man." However, Robert, the oldest son, says that Autofocus captures the true essence of his father. Robert served as a consultant and played a small role in the film. He is also quoted as saying that it's just a movie, it's not the biography of Bob Crane. Bob's younger son, Scott, said this about his older brother, Robert. "Bobby accepted $20,000 to sell out his father's life. To say this totally untrue, unflattering portrait of his father is okay for $20,000. They offered me that deal and I said no. I said, I only want the truth out there." The film's director, Paul Schrader, says this movie is not supposed to be a literal retelling of Bob Crane's life. He says, "Certainly, when you create a fiction, you have to manipulate reality. And yet I can't even tell you how many people recommended that movie to me when I told them that I was doing an episode about Bob Crane." And honestly, I think there could easily be a movie about Bob Crane and true stories of his life. I don't think it was necessary to exaggerate and bend the truth so much in order to tell a compelling story. I get that people have freedom of speech and can tell whatever story they want, but it doesn't seem fair that someone could fabricate a story and create a character and then name that character after a real person, allowing the audience to believe that this character in Autofocus is Bob Crane. Like, that sounds like defamation to me. I cannot say enough how grateful I am that the biographers Carol Ford and Linda Groundwater stayed in contact with me and helped me make sure that I got the true and accurate information from firsthand accounts. After Bob's death, a lot of members of Bob's family and his friends vowed not to discuss him with the media unless they could speak highly of him, the way that they remembered him. But unfortunately, nobody wanted to print what they wanted to say, and so they went silent. A legacy was forced on Bob Crane that he neither wanted nor deserved, and if not for the three biographers who got together to create this book, those voices may never have been heard. And who knows the truth? If Bob weren't murdered at 49 years old, maybe he would have beat his addiction. Maybe he could have told his story and he could have helped others. Maybe he could have taught us his tricks for the radio and about the incredible people that he got to interview. Maybe he would have been able to write his autobiography and tell his own story. Now, there's one more thing that I wanted to share, and it's super random, but it's something kind of crazy that happened to me while I was investigating this case. And I'll tell you the truth, a part of me thinks that I shouldn't be telling this story, but you know what? People really shouldn't tell me fascinating things if they don't want me to talk about it on my podcast without telling me that I shouldn't share it. So, I live in Las Vegas, and here we have a museum that's called Zach Bagans Haunted Museum. You may have heard of it. Zach Bagans is a paranormal investigator who leads the show Ghost Hunters. So the Haunted Museum is where he collects all of this, like, kind of spooky artifacts and memorabilia. Like, he's got a chair from a real exorcism and, like, part of, like, the boat from Natalie Wood's death. So recently, I saw that the Haunted Museum was looking to hire someone who is an excellent storyteller and who has an interest in spooky things. So I applied for the job, and I won't share why I didn't take it, but of course I took a copy of my book to my interview. If you don't know about my book, it's exactly the same as my podcast. It's called Broken Limelight, Shocking True Crime Stories About Celebrities. So I took my book with me to show them that I have, like, a lot of related experience, and I am 100% a storyteller and interested in spooky things. So I was interviewed by the general manager, and as he's sifting through my book, he stops and he asks me, "Do you know about Bob Crane?" And I went, Yes, that's the case that I'm researching now. So this guy goes on to tell me that because of what they do at this museum, they often get offered all kinds of weird stuff. And when they get something cool, first they determine if it's legitimate. Then Zach Bagans decides if he wants to keep it in the museum or not. Apparently, someone came to them with the bag of evidence from Bob Crane's murder case. Zach Bagans decided not to keep it for one reason or another, but the general manager decided to keep it for himself, at least for the time being until he figured out what to do with it. So he became interested in, like I said, they verified that this was all legitimate, and this bag of evidence contains, like, the autopsy report and the bloody pillowcase and, like, anyway, he pulls out his phone and starts showing me pictures of himself holding the evidence bags. And, like, you can see the bloody pillowcase and, like, the electrical cord and shit inside the bags. And then he compares them to pictures that he pulled from the internet that show the evidence bags during the trial, like, in the court. And you can see from the photos that the bags look identical and they have, like, identical handwriting on them. So this guy starts telling me that he came across this evidence bag and he kind of became interested in Bob Crane again. So he started listening to podcasts about it, and in one of these podcasts, one of Bob's sons, I'm not sure which one, spoke to the interviewer, and they talked about how this bag of evidence had either been lost or destroyed, and nobody knows what happened to it. Except this general manager at the Haunted Museum who happened to come across it, and me. And now all of you. One last thing, I just want to finish off with a quote about Bob. Bob had a way about him that could brighten the darkest day. He made others feel good about themselves with a generosity of spirit rare in anyone. And yet, whenever Bob Crane's name is brought up, no one mentions any of the beautiful things that people say about him. Instead, any positivity that he managed to create gets replaced with whispers about his sordid lifestyle. And whether or not you agree with the choices that he made, Bob Crane was brutally murdered and his killer got away with it, and no one deserves that. All right, that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Thank you so much for your continued support. Always remember that you can go to brokenlimelight.com and find a recap of the episode, like a full-ass transcript along with photos, videos, any kind of related information that I can find. I'll put it all on one page. You can also go to that website to buy merch. You can send me a message to suggest episodes. And you can even check out what I've been up to on my live events like my concerts and my singing career. Speaking of which, guys, you're not gonna believe this. So if you're new here, I'm a singer in Las Vegas. I'm gonna be performing in Hollywood on the Sunset Strip at the Whiskey A Go-Go, opening for the legendary 80s metal band Quiet Riot on Friday, December 8th. For more details, go to my website, ddwestmusic.com. I'll post a link there for tickets. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel. I'm under DD West. And also you can find me on all the social media channels under DD West, or you can go to Facebook to look up Broken Limelight. Please stay tuned for part two of this episode to hear an exclusive interview I did with two of the three biographers of Bob Crane, the definitive biography, Carol Ford and Linda Groundwater. Thanks, fam.
Hey, future Unnaturalists, I'm Emily.
And I'm Andy.
And we are the hosts of Unnatural, a true crime podcast.
Each week, we'll dive into some of the most unnerving crimes that this unnatural world has to offer.
Listen for Unnatural on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, make good choices.
And don't get got.
Bye.
Bark box, bark box, bark box. You guys know my dogs, Jude and Eleanor Rigby. Well, we just started getting them bark box, and I'm telling you, your dogs will love you. No more are they angry at the mailman. No more, I say. It's like a box of dog joy that's delivered every month, and each box tells a different story with different themed toys, treats, and photo-worthy props. Typically, what we get in each box is a couple of toys, a couple of treats, and a chew, but you can actually tailor-fit your box to fit your dog's needs. Guys, I'm telling you, your dogs will love you, even more than they already do. So try it out, and if you use my link, you'll get a free extra month of BarkBox, which is a $35 value. So just head to BarkBox.com/BrokenLimelight and get started on your first BarkBox today. BarkBox! 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 Nailed it, Jude.